Go, Sprint Lectures on African Mobilities, a podcast by Africa Multiple.
Welcome everybody to this session of the Sprint Lectures. Today, we are glad to have another talk entitled African States in World Markets, Systemic Hierarchies and the Postcolonial International Political Economy of Governing Senate. This talk is going to be given by Kai Codenbroek. So Kai, I think you will have to make a self-introduction because it's the first time I'm meeting you, so probably could know more about, first of all, your work and other things before you start the talk. Thank you. Kai.
Thank you, Paddy. My name is Kai Codenbroek. I'm one of the four new junior research group leaders at the Africa Multiple Cluster of Excellency at our beloved University of Bayreuth. And I'm leading a group on the topic of economic and monetary sovereignty in West Africa compared, where we have four case studies: Nigeria, Ghana, Senegal, and Ivory Coast. And I myself, I'm doing the research on Senegal at the moment. And the paper that I sent around is my attempt of, first attempt of making a both conceptual and empirical point about the ways Senegal has tried to navigate the waters of world market pressures in post-independence period. So I'm going to make three points. So first, I'm going to introduce all of you non-IR, IPE people to the disciplinary intervention that I'm trying to make. And then we'll talk about the anarchy and hierarchy problematique and the return of systemic questions in the face of climate and financial crises. I will try to develop the notion of systemic hierarchies, which is at the heart of this paper, along the two dimensions of global volatilities and domestic durabilities, and then give you some empirical and historical insights on how Senegalese political economy has changed and how governments have tried to change and alter their submission or subordination to specific hierarchies. And I will do this with a reflection on the term immobilities of funds, of prices of exports, and of social relations in peanut agriculture. So I'm very glad there's historians and geographers in the room who are really experts on these kind of questions. So what might appear odd to a political science audience is probably quite normal for geographers, for example, to be talking of questions of agriculture, for example, and climate. So my discipline, overall discipline, is political science, and my sub-disciplines are international relations and international political economy. International relations was founded as a discipline of foreign policy consulting, basically. So thinkers were trying to make, to give advice to rulers and leaders and presidents and governments of how to rule more effectively to increase international standing of their own state. So it was founded as a discipline that was international, that then turned into international relations, that was always quite close to power. And because of this attachment to the state and to the government somehow, or that might be one of the reasons for it, it became a very state-centered discipline. So people were thinking about world politics as that which is going on between states. And since there is no world government, but there's, let's say, nearly 200 states today, they are all formally equal and in anarchical relations with each other because there is no world government. So conceptually, international relations has for a very long time tended to think about world order in terms of anarchy. Because it's, you know, what is happening in the world is the interaction of states which are formally sovereign and formally equal. Of course, there was always a little bit of a debate about hegemonies like the US leadership, but conceptually it was mostly focusing on what we call the billiard ball model, where states are interacting with each other like billiard balls. And the notion of hierarchy popped up here and there in the last 20, 30 years, but was wasn't really used anymore. And hierarchy denotes obviously the opposite of anarchy and comes from the term, and I will develop that a bit later, in the Greek hierarches, the sacred ruler. So it's a notion that denotes domination and inequality. And maybe triggered by questions after the financial crisis, where it became really clear that some states and some actors were suffering more from the financial crisis than others, the return of debt crises, and also the climate crisis in recent years, as well as what in international relations has become known as threats to the so-called liberal international order, questions of inequality and hierarchies in the global realm have come back to the fore. So international organization, the most influential, most important American journal in this discipline of international relations and IPE, for example, recently published a special issue on the liberal international order, which is, it is a sort of a consensus, is an apt denominator for the world we live in. We are living in a liberal international order, and this liberal international order is under threat. There's crisis. The rise of Trump was kind of disconcerting. Then Brexit took place, which was like a rupture in liberal teleological positive thought. So there's self-searching and soul-searching going on in the discipline of international relations, because things that seemed normal and harmonious are not so certain anymore. So this brings an opening, I think, to consider questions of global inequality and systemic questions as well, anew, because things are not as settled and clear anymore. And it's not as easy to talk about an orderly interstate world anymore, because everything is up in the air. And the threat of China, obviously, also is lurking. So for a discipline that is close to power, it was quite Western dominated and Eurocentric. The threat of China is, the rise of China is a serious problem. And this brings an opening as well to new considerations of hierarchies. And as I said, in this paper that I sent around and which I tried to develop, and I'm trying to do that with the notion of systemic hierarchies. I'm surfing the was a slight proposition a few years ago by Ayşe Sarakol, a professor of international relations at Cambridge University, who was arguing, well, we have to look at hierarchies much more. And there's two understandings of it, one between actors, and also systemic questions should come to the fore. And in the paper, I try to develop the notion of systemic as something that is recurrent, encompassing, and with an identifiable logic. And I'm coming at this notion of systemic or systematicity from the theory of capitalism, basically, and I'm trying to break this down into several components. So under capitalism, interaction is ruled by competition. The price mechanism plays a very important role. Capital as the compulsion to invest money, making a profit in the process, to have more money is an important part of this dynamic. And there is like a global division of labor that is animating this. Of course, there's lots of debates about the proper usage of the term about naming our global system. So there's debate about racial capitalism, about racism, about gender. In the end, all these different intersectional perspective would have to be made sense of together, but I'm focusing here like on the economic dimensions that come with capitalist competition. And hierarchy then means, when it is systemic, that certain actors, when they want to interact with each other, have to subordinate themselves and have to adapt to global processes or global relations that they cannot themselves shape massively. So they just have to subordinate themselves, which I would say is a classic way of the meaning of hierarchy. You are under a hierarchy under the sacred ruler when you have to bow your head, when you have to adapt, when you have to subordinate. And I think this is an apt terminology to make sense of what Senegalese governments have been trying over recent decades. And to make that clear, I break down this notion of systemic hierarchies into two dimensions. First, global volatilities, and second, domestic durabilities. So the Senegalese government, which I'm then focusing on, has to subordinate itself, has to react to, has to adapt to global volatilities coming with the volatility of external funding, for example, but also global volatilities originating in massive movements in world market prices for important exports. Within the country, longstanding colonial past dependencies hamper the self-determination or the room for maneuver for the Senegalese government in specific ways. And I'm looking most specifically at the attempt to restructure the agricultural sector since independence. And it is not a monolith. So agriculture in Senegal has definitely changed substantially over the last 60 years. But there's been massive setbacks, and it was very difficult. And also, there is a dilemma, which I will focus on later on, of dealing with the peanut economy that has not really been solved until today, 6 years after independence. And I try to make sense of this with the term domestic durabilities. So it takes a long time. It's very hard for the government to shape social relations within their own country. So this is also something that in a way they have to adapt to, that they have to subordinate themselves to, because they can't change the institutions with a blink of an eye. It takes a long time and it's difficult. So global and domestic dimension. I think these durabilities and volatilities in global and domestic relations fit quite perfectly the mechanisms and hierarchy relations that I'm trying to analyze in the paper and in my broader work. So the flow of finance, for example, or government funds, sometimes it's very forthcoming, sometimes it is withheld. So when it is withheld, it's immobile, it's staying. When it's coming, it's useful. Also, exports, sometimes there's a better harvest, sometimes a worse harvest. And the climate processes play a massive role in determining how the harvest will be, but also import and export relations with barriers to trade impact on the mobility of these particular commodities. And the society in general and specific social or agricultural economic sectors are also mobile or immobile in different ways. So most people in Senegal are still some way or the other connected to their home country or home village. And some parts of the family are also are all engaged in some respect in some kind of peanut growing on the one hand, but also then there is this important influence of the Mourid religious Muslim societies and brotherhoods who are playing a big role in the rural areas in shaping this peanut agriculture. And people are moving in and out of these relations, are moving in and out of cultivating peanuts, depending on, again, how profitable this agriculture in a particular point in time is, or to what extent they have to fall back on some kind of self-sufficiency agriculture in particular kinds and points in time. So this is just the graph on the volatility. So I will show you three graphs. This graph exists to underline the notion of global volatility and of the mobility of funds. So you see here distinguished along the dimensions of the chronological graph, distinguished by four presidential regimes, starting with Léopold Senghor, moving on to Abdoulaye Wade, and then Macky Sall. And you see here on the low blue line is the import excess that Senegal displays. So it has always historically imported more than it exports. This has to be financed. You need to earn money to finance these imports. And on the other side, in the upper part of the graph, you see different sources of funding. Multilateral credit, bilateral credit by commercial banks, bonds, and aid flows. So you see very basically, I mean, and this is, I'm showing you this graph not to analyze it in detail because this is a sprint lecture, but to just show you the massive volatility that exists. So the Senegalese government at a very basic level, I mean, you all know that, right? I'm not telling you anything new, is exposed to massive financing volatilities. It is exposed to them, it is subordinated to them, it is underlying a hierarchical relation here, because these actors who are willing to give these funds, is it commercial banks, is it the IMF, is it aid givers, or the receipts from exports or the prices of imports, this is not something that the Senegalese government can control. So it's systematically and hierarchically subordinated to them. So this is to sort of, and in the context of the paper, to strengthen this argument that this very basic notion of systemic hierarchies needs to be part of our vocabulary in international relations and international political economy. And similarly, the second component is this exposure to global world market prices, another dimension of global volatilities. And I'm just giving you here the nominal value of Franc CFA peanut export value from 1965 to 2015. You see here it's a massive up and down, mostly determined by climate conditions, but also obviously by world market prices and the agricultural choices that farmers then make as a function of these prices at a particular point in time. Sometimes these prices were very high because there was high demand. Sometimes they're very low. At the moment, interestingly, there's much more demand. I will get to this in a second, because China has begun to import so much the arachide de bouche, so eating peanuts, directly with the farmers in the urban areas, that now the line is going up and it's continuing to go up. So peanut is undergoing a renewed boom. So that is about the first dimension of systemic hierarchies, the global volatilities dependency on funding, and on the other hand, world market prices. Domestic durabilities, I just want to highlight with this graph, which shows a selection of mostly agricultural products, but particularly export products. You see here that there's a change in value, but you also see that that it's not just peanuts. So the peanuts, cereals, and vegetable oils, it has become, after Senegal was dependent to 80% on peanut exports at independence in 1960, this has diversified. So domestic durability doesn't mean that everything stays the same, but that over a long period of time, the government has actually been able to diversify the export structure of Senegalese economy. But this came with massive setbacks. Yeah, Mamadou Dia was the first prime minister under Leopold Senghor, and I did an interview with the head of the Senegalese peanut marketing agency in Dakar recently, and he told me that Senegal doit se libérer de l'arachide en s'appuyant sur l'arachide. So we need to liberate ourselves from the peanuts by banking on the peanuts. And this is exactly the conundrum, the paradox that Senegal has been in for the last 60 years. It has managed to liberate itself somewhat, but the fact that the peanut growing is becoming more important again shows that a real liberation from the peanut has not taken place. And it has also been important to stick with the peanut because it was just the only export product for quite some time. So I think this Mamadou Dia quote, who was then sent to prison for 12 years because he became too transformative for Senghor and French interests at the time, encapsulate well the dilemmas and the systemic hierarchies that Senegal and Senegalese governments have continued to be subordinated to. I want to end with some possible implications for our mobility section and the cluster more broadly. So I think that similarly to IR, so international relations and IPE, we would profit from taking hierarchies and inequalities between actors and beyond, so systemic hierarchies, more seriously, and not dissolve them a lot in complex terms like multiplicity, reflexivity, relationality, where we may lose sight of these very basic structured and systemic relations. They are also important, I think, these terms that are stressing the complexity and relationality, but we should also focus, I mean, in the self-description on the, of the mobility section, inequality features, and it's clear that we all are interested in that, but I think conceptually it's worthwhile to take these very basic systemic hierarchies a bit more seriously. And that entails also to think afresh about today's systems and structures at the national, regional, and global level. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm very much looking forward to your criticism and questions and remarks.
Okay, thank you very much, Kai, for this very wonderful and informative talk. It really opens up new horizons for thinking about how maybe possibilities of doing further mobility studies following things like hierarchies. I'm already thinking about hierarchization of space, for example, looking at Senegal in terms of maybe the global systems that are operating to try and subordinate Senegal. Now, without much thinking, let's just open up the line. Yes, Martin.
Yeah, thank you, Kai. I have three questions. Do you see in the efforts to overcome the peanut economy in Senegal or in other strategies that you or others have identified in Senegal, something like a Senegalese way? So maybe a translation of what Sevinsa called for, not responding to the receipts of the West, but reinventing the synthesis of traditional contemporary approaches, would be my first question. Then a word about mobility. So a question about the conceptualization of mobility. I mean, I think we agree that capital does not really flow. But it jumps in the form of financial products charged with power symmetries, asymmetries, and then jump away again. Do you have an idea how this particular form of mobility of, let's say, money could be conceptualized? And the third question would be your approach. Can this approach be transferred, or how and how far can this approach be transferred to other economies in West Africa to better understand what's going on? I see Kamal Donko here, let's say in Benin with cotton. Or does it, you mentioned these presidents and Senegalese presidents, or does it depend on the personal agendas of presidents? You know, we have in Benin now, we have a president who's copying the Rwandan model, for example. Okay, that's on my side. Thank you.
So sorry, I just had to go get a pen because these were such a challenging question. On the first question, I would just say I've been, as a political scientist, at the moment still quite governmental, and in the Plan Sénégal Émergent, so the Plan Emerging Senegal that Macky Sall has been pursuing since 2012, I don't see much of let's say, special Senegalese strategies. It's a very classic strategy. Let's build stadiums, let's build conference centers, let's build high-speed trains. Let's also develop the peanuts sector, funnily, which Abdoulaye Wade, the previous president, he really wanted to get away from the tyranny, so-called tyranny of the peanuts, and didn't mention it even anymore. So I think it's a classic industrialization, modernization agenda, at least at the current governmental level. But yeah, I'm still at the early stages of the research, so maybe some other more, as you say, Tharian approaches might surface after more research. Yeah, I think the conceptual question on the mobilities thing, this is something I cannot do here on the spot. It's a very challenging question. So capital jumps, capital flows, and how does money come in there? I think we should do a workshop on that, because I could, I don't know how much you like conceptual theoretical thinking. I love it. I think we could do something about this. The third one, yeah, I mean, absolutely. So what we've been trying in the team, so the comparison or the applicability to other cases, we've been trying as a very first step to analyze all the historical the evolution of the export structures, for example, of the four countries that we're looking at. And I think it's highly instructive. I don't know about the Benin case, how high was the utter dependence on cotton. But Senegal is quite special in a certain way that it was so monocultural. I don't know about the other countries yet, but Ghana and Ivory Coast have all been, from the start of independence, been a bit more varied. Nigeria now is a bit similar in terms of oil dependence, but that comes with other challenges. So I think this this approach of systematically looking at how post-colonial governments try to get away from the totally overpowering degree of submission to colonial structures and world market dependence is a valid approach, because at the heart of it is the question of government finances, because governments do politics by spending money, and they get finances through exportation and taxation and aid. And systematically, as political scientists, focusing on that, I think opens research problematiques that are not explored enough in my disciplines of international relations and international political economy, especially with a view to the global south. But that, again, is discipline specific, because political science is so dominated by research on the US and Europe, which is slightly different, I think, in geography, which had a global south focus, I think, I have the impression, for longer and more broadly. But thanks for these great questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Kai. We count very much on you for developing a mobility approach to China capital. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't see any other hands up. Maybe I could now ask my own question, which is a little bit strange that you're going to hear it. What is special about this topic of hierarchies in the context of Senegal? Because I could see hierarchies almost everywhere. I could, it feels for me like when you begin to look at the idea of hierarchies as creation of a field of subordination and domination, then it's almost everywhere, because it doesn't have to be in Senegal. So what is particularly special about Senegal, or in the context of, let's say, global south, global north relations? Could we begin to imagine that hierarchies are pre-designed and located somewhere, and it has a unidirectional pattern that it moves from one end to the other, and it cannot be reversed? That at one point you have Senegal setting its own hierarchies.
Yeah, I mean, in a way I agree with you that hierarchy, you can find hierarchies everywhere. And in intra-social or internal hierarchies, let's say between the urban elite and the rural farmers, for example, are also extremely important. As you see from my presentation, I'm focusing most here on the exposure to the world market and global relations and foreign funding, and the attempts of the government to transmit these pressures and these hierarchies that they underlie by reshaping their own domestic political economy and dealing with their own society. So I think the challenge that you raise is, does it make sense to speak about hierarchies at all, because they are ubiquitous, they are everywhere? I think that's a good question, and I think it connects to what I was trying to say at the very end. I have the impression that in the language that we use in the cluster, we tend to dissolve many very clear-cut relations of hierarchy that are identifiably unequal or hierarchical in a language of flow, relations, multiplicity, which rather hides the simplicity of some of these relations as they are very clear cut. I don't know if that's a good response to your complex question, but yeah, that's the one I can come up with at the moment. But thanks.
We'll take Robin and then we come back to Joel.
Yeah, hello everyone. Thanks Kai for the presentation. Really found it very interesting, the like conceptual debate, which is definitely, I mean, it reminded me of some of my BA classes in international relations. I mean, of course, the level was much higher, but I always enjoyed the billiard playing with
concepts. Ah, you knew that term. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, how can you come up with something like that?
So I wanted to challenge a bit, I mean, probably you might say me that it doesn't fit at all into your framework, but I was wondering about the role of farmers, of companies, like the role of market structures in your approach of systemic hierarchies. So if I mean, of course, obviously there was a shift, like a transformation of the peanut industry, peanut market structures in Senegal. I don't know much about it, but I guess the access to fertilizers, to seeds, to the tools changed probably. So I don't know and how far it fits into your approach. I mean, of course, you're more interested on the state level, huh? But still the relation between the state and farmers or companies might have changed. I don't know if you observed anything during your field work. It would be interesting to find out a bit more about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. I mean, yeah, I've been trying to trace the history of the four, I don't know how you call that, the oil processing production sites, and the approach to, as you say, provide fertilizers, set the price, the annual price for the harvest and all that. And it's also been like an eternal back and forth. So nationalization after independence, reprivatization, after a massive debt crisis of the farmers in the late 70s, because the state had been imprudent with this funding. And then also in the 2000s, and basically 2 years ago, a renationalization after another round of privatization of the state peanut marketization agency, while these four huileries have all been sold to mostly foreign companies. Only one is still run by the Sonacos. So for me, that also shows it's a constant attempt to try, you know, they tried what they called African socialism, so more of like development-led or state-led development. Then they tried structural adjustment, there are neoliberal approaches. Now it's kind of a mix, not really ideologically clear. But the underlying fact remains that government finances continue to be extremely volatile, that the ability to really make long-term policies, long-term planning continues to be low because all the export products are still, I mean, non-processed goods. The exposure to volatility remains basically the same. And this trial and error approach about nationalization, privatization, just underlines this. So it seems to me that unless you are China with a massive domestic market and basically an ultra authoritarian state since Mao, for small countries with small populations and also arid areas like Senegal, under these particular world market conditions, there's not much that can actually be done apart from some, you know, muddling through slight diversification of the agriculture, a bit of more food sufficiency, but a real takeoff, I think it's totally unrealistic to think like that. The entire development logic applied in the entire sector to these cases, I think it's utopian actually, and ideological also.
Okay, Joel.
Yes, thanks. Can you tell us something about the agency of the political leaders that you are looking at? And I'm thinking of you start your paper with Macky Sall, and then you populate a strong continuity between Senghor and Macky Sall, but obviously they are not acting at all in the same country. You know, Senegal coming from 3-something million inhabitants to today 16 or 70 million inhabitants. Macky Sall is facing a huge political competition. which Senghor did not have to face. So the domestic durability that you're pointing at, how much agency do these leaders have in terms of gatekeeping, in terms of adapting, diversifying, and
yeah, I think that's a really important question, and it's brutally hard to have a good answer. So, for example, yesterday I was discussing with my colleague here in the house, a philosopher from UCAD in Dakar, and he was saying, yeah, sure. I mean, if the government has the political will and spent the money differently, of course we could get rid of our dependency on the peanuts. And I would like to agree, but I'm not sure. But I think this agency question is extremely important. I could say more about this, I think, with a view to two things. So exactly to the question that Robin asked. So how did different governments in different times, as you say, under different contexts, try to still make the best of the situation by relying on the peanuts, by giving out credit in this particular way, by setting particular production structures, and to what extent that failed? That could be one way. But I think so there's identifiable differences, and I alluded to that with, for example, between FAL and WAD. So WAD was really, he wanted to get rid of the peanuts. So in his agricultural plan, it wasn't even mentioned. And now FAL says, because Chinese demand is so high, we should actually bank on the peanut even more. So there's identifiable differences. And they try to pursue different strategies, but I think the results might possibly be not that different. That is my impression, empirical impression so far. Because as you say, there were really, I mean, they can choose different political approaches, and they did. I mean, Senghor, over his 20-year rule, his main job, I think, was to sort of, build a domestic business elite, which he partially achieved, also by strong links to the state sector, obviously. How sustainable this kind of arrangement is of course, another question. So there is a lot of agency, but the most difficult question is, I think, while there is this difference, to what extent do they really produce lastingly different results in terms of social and economic relations and the structure of the economy on the ground?
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much, Kai Kordenbrock, for this very wonderful talk. I think time is up for us.
This was On the Go, Sprint Lectures on African Mobilities.